from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, yesterday Israel launched a ground invasion of the Gaza Strip, further escalating the ongoing conflict. We'll discuss the latest round of violence. Then, in the bottom half of the hour, we examine the downed Malaysian Airlines jet carrying nearly 300 people that crashed in eastern Ukraine. We'll talk about what this tragedy means for the geopolitical balance moving forward. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Israeli tanks rolled into the Gaza Strip overnight, escalating the conflict with Hamas. At least one Israeli soldier and more than two dozen Palestinians were killed after the ground offensive began, bringing the death toll to two Israelis and more than 250 Palestinians. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Friday told troops to remain ready for a significant expansion of the offensive, which is aimed at Hamas's weapons arsenal and tunnels used to send militants from the Palestinian territory into Israel. Since the 11-day conflict began, Hamas has fired more than 1,500 rockets at Israel. Joining us first is Nicholas Casey. He's foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and he is in Gaza. Nicholas Casey, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks.
Can you tell us what the situation is in Gaza right now?
Well, last night we all got alerts that Israel was beginning an incursion. This was something that everybody had been waiting for because there was a massive buildup. They came in. You could hear lots of booms. There was lights, fireworks. There's plumes of smoke. And today they've been continuing that bombardment. People are staying indoors. People are trying to not get out on the streets too much. And basically Israel is continuing this operation, which they say is to find tunnels which are burrowed under the earth between the Gaza Strip and Israel, which they want closed right now. However, they say they might be going beyond this at some point to do other things here in the Gaza Strip. We don't know.
So is most of the violence right now still in the northern areas and along the coast, or is it moving into the cities at all?
So far, there's been no Israeli soldiers anybody has seen in Gaza City, and most part it looks like they're staying out of the cities. They're saying that they're trying to target infrastructure that Hamas has, and that also keeps it away from the centers of the cities and out towards the areas that have borders with Israel. A lot of them are agricultural areas, but these are areas, because the Gaza Strip is so dense, they have a lot of people living there as well. So a lot of people are losing their homes. A number of people are in their homes when these strikes are happening or nearby and getting hit by shrapnel.
What are you hearing the people saying that they're most concerned about, besides their safety, of course? Is it the length of the...
Well, I think they're most concerned that this will happen again. This is like the third time that this has happened in just a few years, that Israel and Hamas have ended up in a conflict like this, which has resulted in hundreds of people dead. It's one thing to have a war, but when it's a war that you could expect a ceasefire that will only last, who knows, maybe a year, maybe less, that's, I think, what concerns people the most, that, you know, this is going to be happening all over again at some point, probably not in the distant future.
And I understand you met with family members of the four Palestinian boys who were killed on the beach?
I did, because I saw them. I saw their bodies being taken out. I was in the hotel when it happened. And the next day I went over to the home of the boys, which isn't that far here from the hotel. The family is a very large family that has, you know, so old and kind of established, they have a neighborhood named after them. They're mainly fishermen. And I saw the father and two of the children, and the children were very shaken by what happened. There was about eight of them that went out that day. Four of them died, and the two I talked to that were able to survive, one was able to survive because he was able to run really fast, he says, and got away from where the Israeli missile hit. The other hit the ground and then got up and was trying to catch up with the other four when the Israeli missile hit them, and he didn't get hit because he was so far behind.
And Nicholas Casey, I'm sure a big concern is just additional civilian casualties, given, of course, as you mentioned, the density of the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, that's the problem, is there are lots of notices going out from the Israelis saying, get out of your house, go somewhere else. But the big question is, where else is there to go here? It's a very small piece of land. And while the Israeli incursion is happening mainly on the borders, the Israeli airstrikes are happening everywhere. There was this strike which happened right in front of my hotel. Just before we were talking here, I saw a giant plume of smoke come up right out from where my window is. I can open my window here and hear artillery fire coming in from two warships which have been parked out to sea the entire time I've been here. There's not a way to get away from this, no matter what warnings are given.
Well, Nicholas Casey, do stay safe, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Nicholas Casey. He's foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal based in Gaza. We're joined now by Aaron David Miller. He's vice president for new initiatives and distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. And he's advised Republican and Democratic secretaries of state on Arab-Israeli negotiations between 1978 and 2003. Aaron David Miller joins us from Washington, D.C. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure.
And just before I talk with you, Mr. Aaron David Miller, President Obama commented on the invasion just moments ago. We'd like to play a cut from that.
Although we support military efforts by the Israelis to make sure that rockets are not being fired into their territory, we also have said that our understanding is the current military ground operations are designed to deal with the tunnels, and we are hopeful that Israel will continue to approach this process in a way that minimizes civilian casualties, and that all of us are working hard to return to the ceasefire that was reached in November of 2012.
And, of course, President Obama there mentioning concerns about civilian casualties. I mean, I imagine, and I spoke with Nicholas Casey a moment ago about what he was seeing. I mean, what are the chances that they will be quite significant here?
You know, I think the chances are pretty high. I mean, in 9 days, you've seen 250 or more Palestinians killed. A substantial number of those, of course, are Hamas fighters. You know, rules, laws of war, the highest orders to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. You know, I think that the longer this goes on, the greater the danger there is on both sides for a real catastrophe. In 08 and 09, during Operation Cast Lead, the Israelis ended up killing 1,300 to 1,400 Palestinians. A substantial number of those, anywhere from 400 to 500, may have been Hamas fighters. But again, a substantial number of civilians. Even though Iron Dome, this rather sophisticated anti-missile system, has reduced Israeli casualties from Hamas's high-trajectory weapons to one in terms of an actual fatality.
Right, the second
two
death.
Two, actually, two.
But the second death is,
right.
is being reported potentially as friendly fire.
Right. You could end up with, a rocket getting through, causing significant numbers of casualties. So it's just logic. The longer it goes on, the greater the danger of civilian deaths and casualties.
Just to back up a little here, what is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu trying to accomplish?
You know, you've got a very risk-averse Israeli Prime Minister. In 2012, he authorized the call of 70,000 Israeli reservists and didn't use them. That conflict with Hamas went on for a week. And in 2008 and 9, he was not the prime minister that presided over Operation Cast Lead. I think the reality for this prime minister was that if over the last 9 days you couldn't get a stand down or a de-escalation, And if Hamas wasn't going to stop its high-trajectory fire, which it won't, because it needs things that neither the Egyptians nor the Israelis are prepared to give it right now, that it was inevitable that if Hamas wouldn't stop the rockets, then the government of Israel needed to authorize an operation that would, at least on a temporary basis. So I think the objective is to, and again, it's been limited, and just as in 08 and 09 initially, the Israelis tried to avoid densely populated areas, their air campaign has gone very deep, but not their ground incursion. The objective is tunneling, inventories of high-trajectory weapons, rocket launchers, infrastructures, and Hamas operatives, commanders, and perhaps even leaders.
And you've mentioned the 08-09 conflict, so there's some precedent for this. But the circumstances are different, right? Namely, Egypt, of course. Could you talk a little bit about how things are different this time around?
Yeah, you know, remember, though, in 08 and 09, the Israelis lasted 3 weeks, first air and sea and then ground. It lasted 3 weeks. The Egyptians could not produce a ceasefire. The Israelis unilaterally declared one in January and just withdrew. In 2012, the Egyptians were very involved in bringing that week-long confrontation to an end. Now, you have the president of Egypt, the former supreme commander of the Egyptian military forces, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. You do not have Mohamed Morsi, who was the Muslim Brotherhood president during the time of the 2012 confrontation and who was forced out, now in prison, as a consequence of the Egyptian military and broad popular opposition to his policies. So Sisi does not have the kind of relationship with the Islamists that Morsi did, doesn't have the trust, even though Hamas is very dependent because of the crossing points, particularly at Rafah, which they want open on the Egyptians. So it's going to take longer, but the mediator, frankly, is much less important than the deal. And this is not going to stop until both sides have a much greater sense of urgency that it should stop, and neither of them do right now. And it will not stop until there's a substance, a framework for an actual deal. Hamas wants things in order to justify. They entered this confrontation weak, and they could emerge weaker from it still. They need things to justify, you know, the death and the destruction that the Israelis are visiting upon Gaza. Without it, without those things, a fundamental change in the economic status of Gaza, the opening of Rafah, release of prisoners that the Israelis picked up on the West Bank during their sweeps over the past several weeks, the payment of Hamas salaries, 43,000 to 45,000 Hamas employees have not been paid, and they run Gaza. And then a general relaxation in restrictions on imports and exports. Without that stuff, it seems to me this could go on for quite a while.
We're discussing the conflict in the Middle East and the recent ground invasion by Israel into the Gaza Strip. Should Israel have launched a ground invasion? What is the future of peace negotiations? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. This is a half-hour segment, so please call us now. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And Aaron David Miller, you've mentioned that Hamas is weak and that they want things, so they have said that Israel will pay a price, a heavy price, for this. I mean, what can they do in terms of a response on Israel?
Well, again, you have 08-09 as the only real precedent for a significant incursion. There, Hamas did not engage the Israelis directly. They basically remain ensconced in subterranean and underground positions that they've maintained. They use booby traps, IEDs. And, you know, during the course of that three-week operation, the Israelis lost 10 soldiers, 10, four of whom were killed, they think, in a friendly fire incident. So when Hamas talks about costs, unless they've upgraded their capacity to confront the Israelis, and clearly in densely populated areas, all kinds of things can happen. But the Israelis have the capacity to fight at night. Hamas does not. They have incredible intelligence and coordination between ground and air. They have a range of counterterrorism devices, including booby traps and countercharges to defuse traps and IEDs. So I don't know. I don't know whether this is simply bravado, or whether or not Hamas has surprises for the Israelis. We just don't know.
Well, online, Peter writes, on December 3rd, 2009, Aaron David Miller spoke at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco and said, over the next 4 to 8 years, the two-state solution will either come to fruition or it will join with the previous administration on another issue called the dustbin of history. It's been almost 5 years since he made that prediction. Has the two-state solution idea by now been consigned to the dustbin of history? Aaron David Miller.
Well, it's not looking great, and nobody ever lost money betting against Arab-Israeli peace. You know, when I made that statement, I had in mind, 20-plus years of my own efforts to try to get Israelis and Palestinians to reach an agreement. And the fact is, it's not magic or mystery. There's no reason that Israelis and Palestinians can't end their conflict. It just takes three things that we just have not had. Number one, leaders who are prepared to rise above their narrow political constituencies and reach out to the other side and to understand what the other side needs as well as their own needs and requirements. That's one. Number two, it takes a degree of urgency and ownership. No matter how bad external parties want this agreement, the parties have to own it themselves. And ownership is usually driven by pain and gain. That's why people do things in life, including me or you. There are incentives for us to do them, and there are disincentives. And finally, you need a third party, a mediator, who's tough enough, fair enough, and who's prepared to identify this issue as really important in the American national interest. Now, I would argue to you that we simply do not have those three factors in place.
Yes.
That's why I'm so discouraged.
A dearth of leadership is an understatement. Another listener writes, the Israelis make it very obvious that they want to destroy the Palestinians. So what's the difference? Hamas is fighting against occupation. Israelis want to kill them all. They want and have taken the Palestinians' lands, freedom, life. Why do we in the U.S. support this? I do not. And that's reflective of other comments we're getting. I'm wondering, what are the U.S.'s options here? I mean, President Obama has articulated Israel's right to defend itself, but has also been critical of the civilian casualties.
Well, first of all, Israel and Hamas do not have the capacity. Israel does not have the capacity to destroy Hamas, and they do not want to destroy Hamas. My weekly column in foreignpolicy.com this week talked about why Israel and Hamas need one another.
And Israeli leaders have also said...
I don't buy that. That line. As far as the United States is concerned, look, and let me be unmistakably clear here. We have a special relationship with the Israelis that, in my judgment, has impeded our capacity to serve as what I would describe to you as an honest broker. However, we have functioned over the years, and we are the only party that has functioned in this capacity to become an effective broker. We brokered the disengagement agreements in the 1970s. We brokered the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty in 1979. We facilitated the Israeli-Jordanian peace treaty in 1994. And we are called upon, despite our bias, our imperfections, our capacity to side with Israel, we are persistently called upon to play a critical role in this. So I am not arguing we are an honest broker. I just identified the fact that we have an extraordinarily close relationship with Israel for many reasons. You look at any Gallup poll, look at the one for 2014, and look at the numbers. Vast majority of people in this country, and not just the pro-Israeli Jewish community, supports Israel for many different reasons. But at the same time, we have demonstrated in the past that we can serve as an effective broker to actually help Arabs and Israelis reach agreements. So, I don't know how else to respond. I understand the criticism. I am absolutely persuaded, based on my own work experience, working for half a dozen secretaries of state. We are not an honest broker. I would not use that term. I would use the term effective, however.
And let's go to some of our calls. Claudia in El Sobrante. Go ahead, please.
All right. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I wanted to point out some things very quickly. When you talk about Hamas is calling for an end to the occupation, if you read Hamas's charter, which you can find online, what they mean by the occupation is any the existence of Israel, period. Assuming there was never a Palestinian state, there was only the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, but they would like Israel to go away and die, and then all of the land would be once again Muslim and Arab with, you know, restrictions on access to Judaic holy sites, which is what happened when it was under Jordanian rule. Secondly, whenever Israel withdraws voluntarily from any territory that it has occupied, that territory immediately becomes used as a base of operations for attacks on Israel. The Gaza Strip, Israel voluntarily withdrew in 2005, and immediately, this has been going on since 2005, Hamas began shooting rockets into Israel so that the Israeli kids have, you know, 15 minutes to make it to a fallout shelter. There's also videos you can see on that. Well, if you can't run fast enough, you die.
Claudia, thank you. Aaron David Miller, I mean, in terms of what will happen even if, I mean, what does Israel need to do to dismantle Hamas without actually toppling them? As you say, they don't want to.
They can't. They can retard, erode for a period of time Hamas's capacity to deliver these high-trajectory weapons. If they get the Egyptians to close the tunnels permanently, they will further erode Hamas's capacity to resupply. But unless the Israelis are prepared to reoccupy the entire Gaza Strip, roughly one of the most densely populated areas in the world, 1.8 million people, roughly two times the size of Washington, D.C., with a 40% unemployment rate, unless they're prepared to reoccupy and stay there, and the Egyptians, by the way, are not prepared, and nor is the Palestinian Authority under the leadership of Mahmoud Abbas able or willing to ride into Gaza on the back of an Israeli tank. The best the Israelis are going to be able to do is to fundamentally weaken Hamas and try to staunch the prospects of re-equipping and rearming. So that sets up, it seems to me, the very real prospects at some point in the future, once this phase is over, of another confrontation. The point that the caller just made, however, is a good one, and it deserves just one additional comment. We are not talking here, no matter how bad the current so-called peace process is, we're not talking here about the relationship between an Israeli prime minister and Mahmoud Abbas, a man unlike his predecessor, Yasser Arafat, whom we dealt with for years. Abbas has given up the gun. We are talking here about an organization, Hamas, steeped in resistance, an ideology of confrontation. And for Hamas, Israel is not, and I'll say this emphatically, a 1967 problem. Hamas, Israel is a 1948 problem.
And that will have to be your last point. Thank you, Aaron David Miller, for being
part
of our program.
Always a pleasure.
We are joined by Aaron David Miller, Vice President for New Initiatives and Distinguished Scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Up next, we discuss the Malaysia Airlines flight that was downed over eastern Ukraine. I'm Mina Kim. Thank you for listening.